As 2012 draws to a close, we're taking a look back at some of the big moments in science this year. Joining me on this little walk down memory lane today are Susan Avery, President and Director of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, Eric Davidson, President and Senior Scientist at Woods Hole Research Center, and Gary Borisy, outgoing President and Director of the Marine Biological Laboratory. Thank you so much for all being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Heather.
We have got a lot to cover, so let's dive right in. This was a really big year for just basic exploration of our world. We've all heard a lot about the Mars rover, Curiosity, up exploring Mars still. But of course, we also had this major moment in exploring the ocean. James Cameron went to the deepest spot on Earth. He returned after decades of no one being there. This is like going to the moon, only even fewer people have been to the deepest spot on Earth than have been to the moon. So Susan, what is the significance in terms of science? This wasn't just a stunt. This is obviously a big moment for science as well.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right here, Heather. Jim Cameron is very excited about ocean science. Not only is he a great filmmaker, but he's really done a wonderful dive, as you said, nearly 7 miles down, one of the deepest parts of the ocean. He went down for about 3 hours, reported back that he saw nothing, but he did leave some landers down there that were collecting data. And those data have recently shown to reveal a wealth of a microbial mats. And as we all know, the majority of the ocean really consists, majority of the ocean biomass is microbial in nature. And so there is life down there in the deepest part of the trenches. His exploration, I think, was quite exciting. His submarine had some wonderful technology advances that we can all learn from in terms of further exploration of the ocean. And I think it's important to realize that both manned and unmanned exploration are equally important, and or unpeopled, autonomous exploration, I should say. And we just had our vehicle Nereus went down to the bottom of the Marianas Trench in 2010, and it's slated for a major systemic exploration of our trenches for next year. So even more exploration to come.
I mean, this is kind of akin to sending those rovers to Mars, that it's easier to get these unmanned vehicles down there. And really, sometimes the science, the data return from those can be even greater than sending a person down there. But there is something really crucial about having a person, their eyes, and even the emotional engagement that happens when someone's down there.
That's exactly right. When you think of space exploration as well as ocean exploration, exploration of any kind into the frontiers, to the unknown, it excites the human spirit, if you will, of discovery and exploration. And there's a lot associated with it. And you're right, the human brain is a marvelous thing, and the human eyes, and what you can see and actually record is something that's very experiential. I myself have had a dive in Elvin, our little submarine, and it is a life-changing experience in many ways to be in this part of a world that's so alien, yet seeing such wonderful environment and discoveries that you've never seen before.
Well, and I think one of the themes that kept coming up, at least for me this year, was this ocean-space connection, and I think just wonderfully encapsulated in the fact that the Navy's newest research vessel that they're building is going to be named after Neil Armstrong. There's just such a connection between the explorers of these frontiers.
Yeah, and that connection is very interesting because, as we all know, a lot of the space shuttles are named actually after ocean exploration vessels, ships in the past. So even our original catch, the Atlantis, was named after the ocean catch Atlantis from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. We're excited about getting our new ship. It should be ready for us and ready to go in 2015.
That'll be exciting. Now, for a little bit of a change here, Eric, back on Earth, climate change is one of the biggest issues in the news these days. We actually just wrapped up earlier this month this year's UN climate talks in Doha in Qatar. These talks have tended to coincide with actually one of the biggest earth science conferences, the AGU. And it makes for this really interesting, I think, juxtaposition, especially as you're following this in the news, between hearing some of the latest developments in science and then seeing the, to most eyes at least, relative lack of action happening at these talks. What was the situation this year?
Well, that's exactly right. At best, you could characterize what went on at Doha, which was the gathering of the Conference of the Parties, the 18th one of those since the signing of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. Their progress there is being baby steps at best towards a new treaty and new funding for trying to get a grip on greenhouse gas emissions and mitigating climate change. And as a contrast, I was spending the last week in San Francisco at the American Geophysical Union meetings. That's a scientific society that has over 60,000 members in the geosciences, climatology, space sciences of various disciplines, and about 20,000 of them gather for this meeting. And there was speaker after speaker addressing how it looks like all of our previous expectations of the rate of climate change that's occurring were mostly underestimates. We're seeing disappearance of summertime Arctic sea ice faster than was predicted. We're on a business-as-usual trajectory for emissions of heat-trapping gases, the worst-case scenario, essentially, as was originally modeled in the 90s. And if that continues, we're going to move past what they call a two-degree world, a world in which the average temperature goes up by 2 degrees centigrade, and probably a 3 or 4 degree world. And recently, the World Bank came out with a report of what a 4 degree world would look like, and it isn't pretty in terms of the challenges of agriculture to feed 10 billion people in the middle of this century, and the availability of water, and the extreme events such as the ones we've experienced this year.
I was just going to say, I mean, extreme weather is, I think, on everybody's tongues, especially with Sandy earlier this fall. And the science associated with trying to figure out if particular weather events are linked to climate change is something that's just been, I think, going at an incredible pace in the past couple of years. And there's some really interesting ideas, at least not confirmed, about perhaps how climate change might have contributed to Sandy.
Right. Scientists have always been very cautious in saying, well, we can't attribute any particular storm to human-induced climate change. But in the case of Sandy, there's a very intriguing hypothesis that there was a so-called blocking high sitting around Greenland that was the result of climate change in the Arctic changing the jet stream, resulting in that high getting established there, which sort of blocked Hurricane Sandy from continuing going north. And so it essentially took a left turn at the Jersey Turnpike and came inland and caused quite a bit of destruction in New Jersey and New York. Estimated, the latest estimates I've seen now are $80 billion worth of damage. Now, that's that particular science of this feedback between the Arctic warming and establishing this blocking high, which would change the trajectory of the hurricane, is still in its infancy. But I think we can say with confidence that when you put more energy into the atmosphere, which is what we're doing with warming the Earth, more water vapor, more energy, that we are intensifying the climate. And so we see that in many ways in terms of the drought that's still being experienced in the Midwest and that devastated corn yields this year, and we see that in extreme events. Another interesting paper that was presented at the AGU was more about the sociology of science, and it shows that scientists tend to err on the side of avoiding drama, is what they said. You know, if you think that scientists make errors, of course we all do, in terms of, you know, the future is a difficult thing to predict. And so you'd expect that there would be cases that we overpredict and underpredict how things are going to change and what their impacts are going to be. But if we were unbiased, you'd expect the overpredictions and the underpredictions to be about equal. But this study showed that in the case of climate change, we have consistently since the 1990s, the scientific community has underpredicted the rate of change and underpredicted the consequences, indicating that the scientists themselves sort of have a bias of trying to avoid appearing that they are, you know, Chicken Little, saying that the sky is falling, and avoid sensationalism. And you can understand why we do that in some ways. But on the other hand, it's our duty to put out both sides in terms of what the consequences, what the full range of consequences could be. And it turns out in the case of climate change, things are going faster than originally anticipated.
I mean, we saw the lowest ice cover by a number of different measures in the Arctic ever earlier this summer. I mean, projections are just a few more years, really, and we may be seeing completely ice-free Arctic summers, which is really quite astounding. But of course, it often takes something a lot closer to home to get people to take notice. And I think Sandy really did that, where, you know, whether or not it's made a huge difference in our scientific understanding of climate change, I think Sandy made an enormous difference in public opinion about climate change. There's just been a lot of of talk, a lot of meetings, a lot of even discussion of the possibility now of actual legislation, which seemed to be a dead end for federal legislation on climate change.
It put climate change science and discussion back on the political agenda, for sure. 1 week before the election, in fact, is when it put it back on the agenda, and it had been almost entirely missing prior to that. And by coincidence, there's also a great movie out this year. At least I hear it is. I haven't had a chance to see it myself. It's called Chasing Ice.
I have heard nothing but rave reviews about Chasing Ice. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Fabulous photography from what I hear, and just really moving to actually feel like you're actually there watching watching climate change in action.
Right.
Yeah. Now, Gary, both the MBL and Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution have received some money from the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. They've started a marine microbiology initiative. And Julie Huber at the MBL was one of the recipients. She's going to be studying microbes that actually live underneath the seafloor. I find this entire area just fascinating and mind-boggling that there could be things living essentially in the rocks at the bottom of the ocean.
Yes, that's right. Julie Huber is studying the microbes on the seafloor. She is one of the recipients of the Moore Awards, along with HUI. This is just one example of where microbes influence our life on this planet. Actually, we live embedded in a world of microbes. They're all around us. They're in the sea, in the water, the sea floor. They're in the soil. They're in the air. They're on our skin. They're in our body. Most of the biomass of the planet is microbial, but yet we haven't really understood or appreciated the full significance of what they do. They are the biochemical and geochemical drivers of the planet. Now, our understanding of what microbes do is being driven at an accelerated pace by a revolution in gene sequencing technology and what's called genomics. This is moving faster than Moore's Law, to go back to Gordon and Betty Moore. Moore's Law, which reflected how fast advances took place in solid-state technology and transistors. So it's even faster with DNA sequencing. And this means now we can understand microbes through the power of sequencing their genes. And this is taking place everywhere. Julie Huber is studying the microbes on the sea floor. And she has to work with colleagues who are on ships and who can sample specimens from the floor. And she's studying hydrothermal vents and undersea volcanoes and bringing back evidence of unique microbial life.
Now, of course, you mentioned also the microbes that are on and in our body. And one of the big discoveries of the year, or I guess this is just the fruition of years of research, was the publication of The Human Microbiome. What is a microbiome and why is it important?
Microbiome is a word that reflects the total composition of the microbes that live in and on our body. We think of habitats in the natural environment, forests, sea. There are also habitats in our body, some like the rainforest, like our armpit, or some dry areas like the surface of our skin, some interior ones, our gut. Every orifice of our body, our mouth is like an open sewer of microbes.
That's a refreshing thought.
It's a refreshing thought. If you look closely enough, you can find many hundreds, if not thousands, of different kinds of microbes in the mouth and several thousand in the gut. So the people who are looking at the Human Microbiome Project, they think in terms of at least 20 different habitats in and on the human body.
Well, and one of the similarities that's coming out of a lot of these studies that, in fact, Julie Huber was kind of key in bringing to light is this idea of a rare biosphere, that there are species that occur just, you know, one or two or even a fraction of a percent, that there are others that are very, very abundant, and those are the ones we tend to know about, but we don't really understand the importance yet of these ones that occur at really low frequencies.
That's right. This concept of a rare biosphere originated in the laboratory of Mitch Sogan at the Bay Paul Center at the Marine Biological Laboratory, that some microorganisms are present in very low concentrations, but then under some unique environmental stimulus may become very abundant. In our body, this takes place after antibiotic treatment, where we wipe out most of our normal microbial flora, and then some others can spring up. It also happens in natural environments, in the Gulf oil spill. certain microbes very good at eating oil sprang up in the Gulf. And so here is an example of microbes working to the advantage of human society. And so it should be pointed out here that microbes are not all bad. We depend on microbes. We think of microbes as pathogens sometimes, the ones that make us sick. But most of the microbes in our environment are doing something useful. The ones in the Gulf, we're consuming a lot of the oil. Another example of this is in plastics. One of the MBL scientists, Linda Amaral Zettler, is working with colleagues at the Sea Education Association and also with HUI on microbes that degrade plastics. You know, human society now creates an enormous amount of plastic. And I think the estimate is that over 70 pounds of plastic per person on the planet get dumped somewhere. And a lot of it finds its way into the ocean. How do we get rid of that plastic? This is a big problem. And people have found gyres of plastic just accumulating within the circular motions of the ocean like a garbage dump. Well, fortunately, some microbes are able to degrade plastic. And Linda Amaral's Zettler's project is to examine them and see if there is something that can be done to accelerate that process.
Susan, while we're on the topic of this plastic pollution in the ocean, scientists this year, it was a very large international effort to come up with a single number to represent ocean health, the Ocean Health Index. Obviously, plastics are going to play into that. A lot of things are going to play into that. Fisheries, climate change. What is the point in trying to boil all of these individually very complex problems into one lump number, an Ocean Health Index?
The Ocean Health Index is something that was driven in part by trying to assess in some quantifiable way the health of the ocean, primarily for getting an idea of what are our impacts on the ocean, what is happening to the ocean in terms of the services it provides humanity and society, basic services then in terms of economic services, tourism, for example, fishing, food, energy, mineral resources, viewscapes. There's a number of what we call ecosystem services that the ocean provides humanity, and they basically provide these services for free. I mean, if you think about it, the ocean actually also produces oxygen, half of the oxygen that we breathe. Every second breath you take comes from ocean processes, the production of oxygen. But the ocean is under stress. Climate change is certainly one of the stressors, pollution, plastics being one of them, but other pollutions, whether it's nitrogen runoffs, flame retardants, metabolized pharmaceuticals that make their way into our ocean environment. Obviously, unsustainable fishing, as well as just the huge demand of a population growth all create. So the idea about the Ocean Health Index was to try to get an overall sense of the health of the ocean defined by these stressors and what humanity has done to help alleviate some of those stressors. So, for example, if you have a marine protected area, you might get a plus in the column. If you dump a lot of pollution into the ocean, you would get a minus in that column. And then those stressors and how they play against certain ecosystem services that were defined for humans. So, in a sense, it's important. I think it was an important study. They collected a lot of scientific data, natural scientific data, a lot of obviously economic data, and other things that involve the ocean shipping. It was quite an extensive effort. Several of our scientists were involved in the advisory board associated with us. It's an interesting paper, and it wasn't just a single number for the whole globe, although you could get one. You had, on average, the ocean got a grade of 60 out of 100 points. But in certain regions, the Ocean Health Index varied anywhere from about 35 up to 85, depending upon your practice. And there wasn't any sort of preferential low numbers associated with cities or high numbers associated with islands. It was a very mixed pot. So it's kind of an interesting paper that really needs a little bit more thought in terms of the interpretation of the results. But that's one definition of ocean health, a very important one in terms of the sustainability of services the ocean can provide to us. But getting back to microbes, the real health of the ocean is probably defined on the biologically healthy biophysical chemical functioning of the ocean. And that's what gets back to this microbial effort and the importance of microbes and the importance of studying these microbes. And as Gary alluded to, the major biomass of the ocean, major biomass of the world, is mostly in these microbes. They are responsible for the food chains, the base of the food chains. They are responsible for certain functioning in our human bodies. Likewise, there's certain functioning of our whole biological system that we find in the ocean. Moving forward, very, very exciting ways of looking at the health of the ocean. One, the Ocean Health Index in terms of defining the ecosystem services and the sustainability of those ecosystem services and how we might better manage the ocean to preserve those ecosystem services. And secondly, the biological, physical, chemical, biological functioning of the ocean and how it's going to be in the future.
If I could jump in, Susan, I might add another dimension, which is biodiversity, the extent of the range of life that is in the ocean. We have evolved from the ocean, and the ocean is our repository of the greatest biodiversity on the planet. And that biodiversity is threatened. We are now, as some people say, in the midst of the sixth extinction of life on Earth, and it's being driven by humans, not mm-hmm. by natural events. And that threatens that life. And it's from that diversity of life that we learn many things. There are many model organisms that have come from the sea, from which we have learned profound insights that affect medical treatments. One example is the squid, from which we have learned how nerve impulses are conducted. And this year, the squid was recognized again with the Lasker Award. Now, this is a very important award in the biomedical arena. It is generally considered to be a precursor or forerunner of the Nobel Prize.
Say, not quite the same name recognition maybe in the public.
But not quite the same recognition, but many people who have won the Lasker Award go on to win the Nobel Prize. It's not a guarantee, but it frequently happens. Anyway, it is a very prestigious and highly ranked award in the biomedical arena. And it was given to several MBL researchers and a Stanford researcher this year for discoveries made using the squid, using the giant axon of the squid. And they discovered in this squid molecular motors. Why do we care about molecular motors? They're not just in the squid, and they're not just in the axon. They're in absolutely every cell of our body, and they're moving cargo around within our bodies. And there are many kinds of motors, and many diseases result from malfunctioning of these motors, including ones that we're all concerned about, such as Parkinson's disease and neurodegeneration, Alzheimer's. So the lowly squid, one example of the rich biodiversity of the ocean, has much to offer society. We need to protect the biodiversity of the ocean.
One of the other factors that influences the ocean of the health, obviously we've talked a little bit about plastics, we've talked about climate change. I think one thing that has really started to come to light more in the past couple of years and really receive some attention this year is the importance of nitrogen. Everybody's familiar with the idea of a carbon footprint, but we're starting to realize that our nitrogen footprint might be just as important. And back at the very start of 2012, Eric, the Woods Hole Research Center put out a big report on the importance of nitrogen and the impacts that nitrogen is having on our environment.
That's right. Of course, it won't be any surprise to the residents of Falmouth or Cape Cod that nitrogen's important and it can hit you in your pocketbook. They're probably learning a whole lot more about nitrogen than they care to know in terms of how we deal with our wastewater here on the Cape. But it's a global issue. It's a good example of needing to think globally and acting locally in our case. But, I mean, the problem arises from the fact that we have 7 billion people, we'll have 10 billion people, and they have to eat. And one of the things we have to eat is protein, and protein is full of nitrogen. And so we have to grow crops and nutritious crops that provide us protein. In some cases, we feed them to animals and then consume the animal protein. And in so doing, unfortunately, it's kind of a leaky system. Some of that nitrogen doesn't go where we want it to go. It ends up in the water. It ends up in the air in various forms. There's a very potent heat-trapping gas called nitrous oxide, the same stuff that the dentist uses, but it traps heat. And nitrate accumulates in drinking water, which is a human health hazard, and it also causes growth of algae and other noxious organisms, places where we don't want them. There are both the good and the bad, but when we have too many nutrients in the system, it causes excess growth and causes significant problems in terms of water quality. And that has come to light recently. We produced a report on climate nitrogen interactions as an input to the National Climate Assessment, not only because nitrogen is one of the greenhouse gases, because it affects the climate system in so many ways. And it has direct links to human health as well, the air we breathe and the water we drink.
It also has, Gary, repercussions for the health of salt marshes. There was a big paper that came out from an MBL researcher this year about the role of nitrogen in the degradation of salt marshes.
That's right, Heather. Linda Deegan led a study on the effect of too much nitrogen and what impact that has on salt marshes. Salt marshes are buffers for our natural surroundings. They do a lot of benefit for us. At one time, New York, Manhattan was surrounded by tens of thousands of acres of salt marshes. And maybe if New York had those salt marshes today, it wouldn't have been so badly impacted by Sandy. So we forget that. So we want to protect these salt marshes. Now, salt marshes are threatened by nitrogen running off from fertilizers, from sewers, and the like. And Linda Deegan and her colleagues through the National Science Foundation Long-Term Ecological Research Project system have been studying the impact of nitrogen on marshes over a period of 9 years. And it's very important to point this out, the importance of long-term funding for effects that you only see over a long period of time. Previous studies on a smaller scale and for a shorter duration really didn't reveal the impact, but now they see it over this long period of time, and they see that excess nitrogen is causing the salt marshes to crack and to split apart and to lose their ability to absorb and buffer the environmental insults that we face.
We could do this all day, but we unfortunately are out of time. We will have an extended list of some of the top moments of science on our website. You can go to capeandislands.org and click on Living Lab to get to that list. Susan Avery is president and director of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Eric Davidson is president and senior scientist at Woods Hole Research Center. And Gary Borisy is outgoing president and director of the Marine Biological Laboratory. Gary, congratulations on your retirement. Enjoy your free time.
I will try to do that, but I do have a research project that will consume a fair chunk of it.
And Susan and Eric, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Heather.
Thank you all for listening. This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Happy New Year.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. Living Lab on the Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.